Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had to taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone. Thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
People who, like the founder of this show, recognize that they are on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustment to be an amazing person. Share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength. Capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulders. Deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. This is Part Sinner, Part Saint, and we are brought to you by Late Night Poets on allpoetry.com. You don't have to be a part of the group to participate, but it's more fun if you are, because you can comment with us and follow along in the chat, reading the poems as we do. I'm Asaziana, and with me I have Babbler. Hello, Babbler.
How's it going? Happy
Pretty
Friday.
Good. Friday. Woo. Also, you know, usually I have Fridays off and I had to work today, so I'm like, I don't know, I can't complain. It was actually a super easy day at work. it was just meetings and we were practicing administering naloxone, so I got to stab this bouncy ball with a smiley face. Which, you know, I was saving it. We didn't waste real naloxone. We used water, but still, I was saving this little smiley face. So, anyway, that was my day. How was yours?
Mine was really long, And I spent the vast majority of the day thinking it was Thursday.
Oh.
But
then it's a nice surprise, isn't it, that it's Friday? Whereas if it, you thought it was Friday and it was actually Thursday, then, yeah. So go one more.
I mean, I've just been off, like, all day. Like, even when a couple people told me it was Friday, like, they were like, happy Friday. And in my head, I'm just like, they're being a sarcastic dick. You know, like, they're not.
That's great.
You know. But sometimes people at work, you know, when they have the next day off, they'll just tell you happy Friday because it's like their Friday, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'm that bitch.
For most of the day. Yeah, eventually I figured it out. I'm like, oh, it's Friday. And then I realized all the things I need to do on Fridays that I hadn't done, so I ended up being at work kind of late. So, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you figured it out, so you're here.
Yep. Otherwise, I'd have been a no call, no show. I've just not been here because I have no idea.
I'd be talking to myself. But, I mean,
well,
what's new? That's
yeah.
Funny. No, it's just, it's great to have you actually here, so I'm glad you figured it out. Can you tell us about your contest?
Yeah, so I put up a contest that is about blindness. So I wanted to explore the concept of blindness, but not really, like, the physical state of blindness, but the mental state of blindness. Blindness is a result of, like, ignorance, obstinance, or fondness. You know, the varieties of blindness that are more metaphorical than physical. And so I've included some quotes in the contest to kind of help fuel some ideas. And this is so funny because one of the first comments I got on the first one is that it's actually like an English proverb, and I kept trying to edit the contest, and things kept crashing. So it still says Stephen King, but it's an English proverb. And that is, there are none so blind as those who will not see. And then quote two is, love is blind, but friendship closes its eyes. Quote three was, there is no dearth of kindness in the world of ours. Only in our blindness we gather thorns for flowers, by Gerald Massey. Number four, a blind man shoots sometimes a crow, which is a Flemish proverb. Number five was, blindness separates people from things. Deafness separates people from people, Helen Keller. And number six was, had the price of looking been blindness, I would have looked, by Ralph Ellison. So, as with most of my contests, the prompts are really just meant as a guide. You don't really have to pick a quote, as long as you're at least tangentially on theme. You know, if I can tie it together, we're good. So that was the contest.
I loved the quotes. I did. It took me a while to decide which one that I wanted to go with. I think that they're wonderful quotes. We didn't have a whole lot of entries, which is sad to me because I think it was, amazing inspiration. But I think we just need to leave our contest up longer. People are so busy right now that they're
yeah.
not jumping on the short ones anymore. But the entries we did get are wonderful, so we're fortunate in that. I'm going to start by reading the one by Daniel Dischino, and this is called Blind Mind. Of childhood vision and the wondrous sight of youth, where a small section of grass on the springtime lawn invites worlds of exploration, deep in the child's shallow future, blinded by aged contemporary distractions, will think nothing to cut down and color the world once discovered to please his blinded brethren. My eyes are open since birth. They have always worked, just maybe a little less widened and less light sensitive. Eyes of color, eyes of expression, eyes to see, and all others to see me. But the eye, just a camera lens, and the mind is photographer, who I can truly see through clouded thoughts, what lens can focus without cleaning from its owner. And the mind, a lake that grows murky with age, surrounded by the forest I am, unkept and overgrown. In the morning, the cold waters of frozen thought grow lifeless, and the crowded forest suffocates in heat, and the fog thickens with dreams of solidify death. Let the sun shine through to burn away the haze, and see the tall grass dance in the wind once more, to delight the child eyes that closed so long ago. End poem.
Great read, Faziana. Sorry, poorly timed random cough there. I really enjoyed this piece. You know, it's kind of about like how you can be jaded, you know, during your youth. You know, as you grow up, stop looking at the world the same way. You know, a childhood vision and the wondrous sight of youth, where a small section of grass on the springtime lawn invites worlds of exploration. You know, it's so true. Like, little kids especially find everything so wondrous. You know, the way they look at everything, they literally are seeing everything for the first time. And even on top of that, they're so small that everything looks so large. You know, that little section of grass really is a big yard to them. You know, and so I just love that it starts with that, like that childhood sense of wonder. And then it gets a bit more into the darker aspects of things, you know, deep in the child's shallow future, you know, is the very next line. It talks about like the limitations of it, that, you know, things are going to change. Contemporary distractions, you know, that makes me think of like television or tablets or, you know, that kind of stuff, that make like going outside and seeing those kind of things, less likely, you know, and you know, less widened and light sensitive, you know, that things just kind of dim, which I, you know, I think a lot of people experience or at least relate to. And then I like how there's a shift in the middle. You know, the eye is just the camera lens and the mind is the photographer. You know, so you'll see what you want to see. You'll see what you take pictures of. You'll see what you take, what you look at. So I really enjoyed that about this piece. You know, it's like, yeah, things can get foggy and things can get murkier with age. But you can change that too. Like, you can go to brighter places. You can let the sun shine through to burn away the haze, as he says. So I really enjoyed this piece. I thought it was a great write. I was going to say something. He just got up and left. Oh, you know, I think I mentioned it. Was it last week's show? Maybe the week before, where, you know, I deal a lot with depression. And when I start to get really depressed, one of the things I do for myself that I learned from cognitive behavioral therapy that actually works really well for me is to find just one small thing to be happy about in a day, and try to focus back on that thing. You know, when I start to get negative, think about that one thing that made me happy. So, you know, if nobody here, I don't think, follows me on Instagram or anything like that, and I don't encourage you to, but typically what's on there are like the pictures of those small things. So a lot of times it's like a cloud that I liked, or a tiny little flower that I saw in a ditch that I liked, or a bee butt sticking out of a plant, like that kind of stuff. Because those are the little things that'll pull me out of my depression. And so that's what makes me think of, because I think those are the same kinds of things that little kids look at with those big eyes of wonder, you know, and I remember how that made me feel as a kid, and I think that's why I'm so kind of attached to just, like, those little moments of happiness. So, anyway, that's kind of what it makes me think of. So I enjoyed
that. I think you're absolutely right, and it's part of why I love working with kids, because they'll point that stuff out to you. You know, the stuff that I might not have taken the time to notice, they will bring me in like a cool rock that they found on the side of the road or something like that, and they're like, look, there's a little swirl in it that kind of looks like a cat, and it's like, it actually does. And then it's like, I don't know, this little moment of joy of like, look what nature can do. And just having a little person show you something like that just snaps you out of it. And so I love that you point that out, and I kind of want to follow you on Instagram now because I want to see those little moments. And I like that you share them because, you know, those little things that bring you joy could also be bringing joy to other people. And that part that you pointed out, with the eye, just a camera lens, and the mind, its photographer, that was a really key part for me. Actually, I highlighted it as I read it because I was like, I want to talk about that. It's just, it's so true that the things that you are choosing to focus on become what matters. And when he's talking about how the trees are all overgrown and the sun's not getting through to the little things, I mean, I think of that as like the trees might be our worries or our responsibilities. So, you know, there's everything that I have to do at work is the trees that are getting overgrown, and then like the chores that I have to do, I haven't done my dishes or laundry, then that becomes like, you know, the overgrown things, and just every little thing. And then the bigger things too, like the pandemic and war and like all those things kind of close it in, so you're not noticing, you can't see the little beautiful things because there's all these huge things looming that like that is where your focus is. And to clear all that away every once in a while and just bring yourself back to that child life wonder is so wonderful. And, you know, Daniel has written about things like this before, like different from this poem. I'm not saying he's repeating himself. I just mean like the childhood kind of innocence and also the nature imagery. And I think those are two things that he's really good at writing. I thought this was like beautifully expressed.
Yeah, agreed. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really well done. And I think I've seen a couple of these before, and some of them have been darker. I can remember another write that he did that was kind of talking about, like, crumbling asphalt, but then the plants grew up in all of the cracks. It was kind of the theme of the piece, and I really enjoyed that, too. But it was similar. It had a similar feel to this one. Excellent
yes.
comment.
I think he should do a book that has, like, I'm picturing that flower coming through the asphalt on the cover, and then it's all of his, like, nature imagery books that tell stories like this. Okay, Daniel, I'm putting you on the spot. You're making a book. I'm going to buy it. Okay. It's happening. I've said it. It's happening now. Babbler, would you please read the poem by Blatant B?
This is Selective Blindness by Blatant B. There are imprints on my lenses, some I never ask for, some that will never dissipate, like mist on my windshield. Chose to close my eyes most of my life will eclipse the darkness as light and spotlight are strange second cousins. Knowing and wanting to know is like dreaming and reality. They only an eye blink apart, a beginning but also a start. Like a video cameras, we switch off the bad parts of the clip and erase the things we are not willing to see again. Edit parts we want to ignore. End poem. I really like this one. I like the rhythmic way that Blatant B writes. He has certain beats that he likes to hit. And it's fun to read the piece because things pop out that you might not notice, particularly by just reading it silently. I feel like a lot of his pieces are meant to be spoken. So I've always enjoyed that about his work. I thought this was interesting, too, because it took a very kind of similar take as Daniel with the, you know, like a video camera, you know, just the lens that you're choosing to look through and how. But this one's a bit different because it talks about how he just shuts out the things that he doesn't want to think about. It's almost like a denial. You know, you switch off the bad parts of the clip and erase things we're not willing to see again, edit the parts we want to ignore. You know, it makes me think of, you know, not wanting to deal with trauma, but sidestepping it, you know, pretending it didn't happen, pretending it didn't exist, you know, that kind of denial. But there's also a bit of it, too, that's like a little bit of even just forgiveness, you know, not so much avoidance, but it's like, you don't have to focus on the bad stuff. You can focus on the good stuff, and that's not all bad, you know. You know, why dwell on the bad stuff? You probably don't want to forget about it entirely, because the bad stuff, honestly, is where you learn most of your life lessons. But probably don't want to dwell on it either. For some reason, it makes me think, too, of, again, like social media feeds, you know. It's a highlight reel most of the time of someone's life. Most people aren't on there, like, talking about their average boring-ass day or, like, talking about, like, how shitty stuff is. You know, hey, I haven't been out of my house in 3 months because I have no money and I've eaten Top Ramen for the last 7 days. How y'all doing? Like, nobody's posting that, you know. You see the highlight reel of their lives. And then the weird fallout of that is other people can feel crummy about the life that they're leading, because for some reason it doesn't look as good as what everyone else is doing. But again, nobody's posting their boring days. And so I think that kind of is kind of reflected in this in an interesting way, because if everyone's switching off the bad parts of the clip and erasing things that they don't want to see, you know, and just kind of closing their eyes to all of the negative things and only sharing good things, then everyone else only experiences the negativity in their own life. And it makes it seem inferior, which I find interesting. I think this gives me things to think about. So I like it because it's not, it doesn't explore anything in like super deep depth, which leaves it open to the reader to explore and to go into tangents of their own thoughts. I really like it in that respect. So I thought this was a great write from Blayton B. What are your thoughts, Tiziana?
I think you touched on some great things there, and I like what you said about the deception of social media in that way, because it's true. It becomes a thing where it looks like everyone's having such a better life than you, when that's not necessarily true. I have a few friends who actually have kind of, like, just taken a break from social media, especially like during the last couple of years when things gotten not great. And it's just like, I don't want to watch all of this. And everyone, you know, bragging about all the things that they've accomplished during their time stuck at home, and feel like crap about myself for not doing all of those things. There were a couple years where it was like every single one of my friends was like getting married or having kids or like doing, like, it was like constant, like, big events happening. And I'm like, so I read a book.
I made a sandwich today. That's pretty good.
Yeah. I like what you said about Blayton B having a rhythm to his work. My understanding is he used to be a rapper, and he's kind of stepped away from music a little bit, but you can tell he has that musicality in him because of the way that he writes. It does have that rhythm. There's a beat to his writing, and it's like it craves to be read out loud. And maybe even sung, although I don't totally know how he would make it sound. Blayton B, I want an audio, please. I think that he has like a natural talent for making things like flow very smoothly. I really liked the part that said, "Dreaming and reality, they only a blink apart." Sometimes you're daydreaming and seeing what's in front of you. You can make that choice in the moment. It's a quick thing. I like the only a blink apart. That's a good way to put it. And the part about like erasing the bad parts and seeing only what you want to see is true and well done. In his AN, he says, I think that this prompt really speaks volumes about what we see and what we choose to see. I see many things, but I'm too scared to see them all. I fear that when I do, my simple existence will crumble. I always love his ANs. He has such thoughtful ANs, usually with his poems. It's like a new poem within the AN. So thank you for that, Blayton B. I like that little extra that you put in there.
Yeah, agreed. I also really like his ANs. They're always worth reading. I like to read them afterwards because I also find that they're usually kind of about his thought process and where he's coming from, which I love knowing. But I also really love seeing where his poem takes me before I read it.
Yes.
I think they have both.
I agree. You have to read his poem and then read his AN and then read his poem again.
Yeah.
That's my process.
Yeah. But I like the think about it step. So, like, read about it, think about it for yourself, and
mm-hmm.
then read his AN and then read it again.
Yes.
Anyway, great write. Thank you, Blayton B.
I like poems that get us to reflect like that, where you have your own interpretation, and then you think about what they actually meant, and then you compare the two, and you go through it. It's one of the fun things about doing this show is I hear your opinion about it. Sometimes our other callers share what they're thinking about it, and then it makes me see things in a new light. And then it's like I get to experience the poem all over again with that new perspective. So it's fun to be able to talk about poetry, not just read it in isolation.
Agreed, yeah. I like talking about it. Yeah, new ideas always pop out. Or a poem that I didn't really get at first, sometimes someone else will really get it. And then when I hear them talk about it, I'm like, you know, you're so right, and I missed that. I love the conversations that come out. Find it interesting. Where are we off to now?
Our next poem is by Amethyst Moonjade, and it's called Blind Friendship. When we meet someone for the first time, we give them wide latitude in their behavior and actions. Only after knowing them for a period of time do we judge if we want to be friends with them or just acquaintances. As friendship develops, so does trust. As trust develops, so does excuses for behavior and words that would not necessarily pass in someone who is not a friend. Where does the line of friendship begin against those things that are personal ideals, philosophies, and beliefs? Does a friendship subsume them, or do you speak up and come to an understanding? End poem.
I like this piece. I like how it kind of works as a narrative. Like, it almost just, like, walks you through the scenario, you know? Like, in this situation, like, what do you do? You know, when you meet someone for the first time, you give them wide latitude. You trust. You're open. You know, at least most people do. And if you don't and you're not that kind of person, it's usually because you've been hurt too many times or at least once really traumatically, you know. You're a lot more closed off, you know. And then as you think you get to know someone or you do get to know someone, you know, a lot of those barriers and boundaries fall down, you know, as you let someone in. You know, I feel like everyone has, like, a series of gates, you know. And some people have a pretty big yard with a lot of gates in it, and other people don't have nearly as many. But, you know, people kind of make it through certain levels of that. And so when I read that last stanza, you know, where does the line of friendship begin against those things that are personal ideals, philosophies, and beliefs? You know, do you let everything go or do you argue? You know, and a lot of, I think what she's getting at here is like differences in ideology, you know, maybe politics, maybe religion, you know, there's all kinds of different hot button issues that can be real dividers, you know. And at least in my opinion or my experience of talking with people, it's okay, in my opinion, to not agree with people. I am fine with being friends with someone who is ideologically opposed to me as long as they are fine with me being ideologically opposed to them. And I am more than happy to talk it out. Let's talk about it. But there has to be that mutual respect and understanding that if I don't agree with you, you know, to not get, like, personally offended. But by all means, like, make your case. I want to talk about it. You know, and in all my years of discussing things with people in person, not on the internet, because people aren't really themselves on the internet. Like, you lose sight of humanity when you're just sitting behind a keyboard. You know, you're separated from the other person's feelings and the other person's perceptions. You lose all the body language. Like, there's a million and one reasons to not debate these things, not in person. But when you're actually, like, sitting face-to-face with people, I think it's so much more evident that, like, everybody wants what's best for everybody. They just have different opinions of what that means, you know, like, and how you get there. You know, I don't know anybody that's just like, oh, I want the whole world to die and I want everyone to fail. And, you know, like, I don't really know anybody like that. I'm sure they're out there, you know, there. There are people who really don't like people, but for the most part, everyone's trying to achieve that same goal. So, you know, where does the line of friendship begin against those things? Respect. I think that's really the only line that there is, you know, ultimately, when it comes to those things. But I love how this poses that question. It doesn't answer the question. It poses it. So it makes you think about it. You know, where is that line for me? I'm not here to change anybody's mind most of the time, but I'm happy to discuss ideas and why I think what I do and learn about why you think what you do. And I don't know, have a broader understanding of how people think and how the world works. So anyway, I love that it just poses it and it pushes you to answer the question for yourself. So I think it's a great work. What do you think, Susiana?
I like the question, too. I definitely think this is a thought-provoking piece. And I like that it kind of wonders about, like, at what point are you able to feel comfortable talking about this? But there's kind of an in-between zone. It's like with new people, you're just going to maybe let it go and not get into it because like, you're not close anyway. With people who you've been, like, BFFs forever, it's harder to bring up because, you know, you're afraid of losing that friendship or you kind of, like, you're blind to their flaws because they're like, family to you. It just becomes, like, well, you know, that's just how they are, or there's a reason, and you make excuses for them. And then there's that kind of in-between zone where it's more comfortable to have the discussion. There are those lines. I feel like I'm always the friend who speaks up possibly a little bit too much. But for me, being a good friend is not being a yes man. It's, you know, telling you when you're fucking up. I think that, I have definitely had conflicts with friends because, like, I had one who was having an affair with a married man, and I straight out said, like, I don't think this man is cool. Like, and so she was like, how dare you say that? And I'm like, well, I'm like, this is going to go badly for him, for you, for his wife. I'm like, it's going to go badly. And then it did, and she was like, well, why didn't you tell? I'm like, I straight up told you not to do this. I'm the jerk. But at the same time, I think sometimes you have to. You know, like, it's like, I don't know. At what time do you speak up? For me, it's always. I have no filter. if honestly, the more I like you, the more honest I'll be about, like, I'll be like, do you really need that? I'm like, no, you're not driving. You just had something to drink. Like, the closer I am to you, the more I will tell you off because I care about you. if I'm, like, overly polite, I'm not as fond. So, if I'm rude to you, be complimented. But I like that this makes you consider it.
I really relate to that. Like, it's funny. I'm not really like, I am who I am when I'm on air, right? But I'm a lot more quiet in actual person, you know, when you meet me face to face. And it's kind of funny because my friends will joke all the time that, like, I'm pretty, they call me savage because I don't have a filter with them. You know, you're going to get what I actually think, and you're going to get my dark, twisted, sardonic sense of humor and my side comments. And I have a very dark sense of humor that's pretty twisted and pretty non-PC sometimes. Which I don't always share because you have to be, I have to know that you're comfortable with that. So that kind of, you know, ties into the theme of this poem because I don't lead with that. Like, no. But also, you have to have those hard conversations. If you can't have the hard conversations, you don't have that deep of a friendship. Because you have to. If you can't talk about the hard stuff, then you're not really that close. And then the other part that everyone sees me is that quiet person when you first meet me. And the reason that is I'm still thinking all of the same thoughts, but then I have a second thought going, is it worth it? Like, is it worth it to invest myself in this conversation? And if I don't know you that well, no. So I just don't say anything. Like, I think the things, and then they don't come out of my mouth because I don't know you well enough. And I guess that's kind of what I meant, too, about Gates. You know, but I always find it kind of funny because people who don't know me very well will describe me as shy, not shy, but quiet, introverted. And then people who know me well are like, she's not really introverted. Don't know her very well. You know, I'll still be fairly quiet. I'm not that loud of a person, but I wouldn't describe myself as necessarily like introverted or shy. So I was on my phone. It's related to what you said. Excellent poem.
I like that.
Really kind of got, you know, a good examination of what that means. So I think that's excellent, especially a poem that generates those conversations in itself. So, great, right, Amethyst Moonjade.
And why don't
what are we doing
you... I'm putting you on the spot with your scarecrow.
All right. Yeah, this is Scarecrow. It's tangentially related. You'll see. So it goes like this. Tell the scarecrow, dancing on the screen, it's lovely to not have a brain. He lives perfectly as he is. A brain is dangerous. All the maybes flood in, trawling the depths, revealing the many ugly truths are ugly, that many truths are ugly. Unable to unknow, some brains break. Sweet songs curdle into a minor key, flipping into crevices, harmonized with new voices. Melodizing, you are lacking. The yellow bricks are just painted. If the wizard is a sham, then what about Glinda? She couldn't resurrect the Witch of the East. You watched her peel the shoes from her feet and sent you on a goose chase that her magic didn't unmask. Send Dorothy off to Kansas, head to the familiar field. You were made to scare the crows, not wonder about the world. Hum softly the songs of autumn grain and live a mindless life away from all this pain. End of poem.
Oh, I really love this. I like the way it delves into the painfulness of knowing, that whole ignorance is bliss sometimes, because sometimes recognizing the things that are awful in the world is just too much. I read a study recently, and I think it was from Yale, but I can't totally remember, that was about how really intelligent people tend to be depressed, and it's because they understand all the things that are wrong, and they have a harder time kind of with escapism and just fully are aware of everything that is wrong with themselves, with the world, just in general. And so that longing to be the brainless scarecrow, I think is real. I also really like the way that you use all the Wizard of Oz references. Like the yellow bricks are just painted. That everything is fake. The wizard is a sham, but that also means the rest of it might be too. You're sent on a goose chase by Glinda. I really liked sweet songs curdle into a minor key, slipping into crevices, harmonized with new voices, melodizing you are lacking. Oh, I relate to that so deeply. And unable to unknow, brains break. You can't get rid of some knowledge once it's there. The glass has shattered. It is something that is always going to be something that you're aware of. The hum softly the songs of autumn grain and live a mindless life away from all this pain. That desire to just close your eyes and erase that knowledge. So I can see how you would say that originally you said this is more about intelligence than about blindness, but I think it is choosing the blindness. It's like in Blatant B's piece when he was saying, you know, edit it and get rid of the parts that are too much. You're choosing to shut off the pieces that are letting you see the truth. By having the brain, you're seeing all of these flaws, and to choose not to is to choose to be blind to what's wrong, to what's fake. So I think this is very relevant. It's a good choice.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm like, it. Technically, I never used the word blind, but... You know, it's that same kind of concept of just choosing to shut out or not see, you know. Sometimes I struggle, you know, just knowing a lot of things that I know or having seen a lot of things that I've seen and looking at them and understanding them, even when I was little, you know, it's hard. And, you know, what's harder is watching other kids go through it. And wishing that they could just not, you know, that you could just preserve some of that innocence. But you can't. And more than can't is that you really shouldn't. And I know that sounds terrible, but, like, you want to protect children and you want to keep them from seeing the ugliness of the world. But the fact is, keeping them from seeing that the world is ugly doesn't stop the world from being ugly. You know, I'm not saying, like, expose them to violence intentionally, but, like, you can't helicopter parent all the time. You know, they're going to see things. They're going to experience things. And more importantly, they should, because it's a more robust understanding of the world. But it does come to cost. Like, there's a price to it. So that's kind of what I was thinking when I wrote it.
Yeah, and it's hard to find that balance because I know it is our instinct to protect them from seeing any of it, but at the same time, you know, when they're older, if they're completely ignorant to everything that goes on in the world, then they won't be the change that they need to be to stop that from happening. And also there's that shell shock, like when you suddenly have it. I had this roommate who was super sheltered. She had been homeschooled, and she had, like, her parents, like, kept everything, like, super happy. Nothing in the world exists that's not, like, you know, perfectly safe. And she wasn't, like, allowed to watch TV. Like, she had, like, no concept of what, like, the outside world was like. And then we were in university, and, you know, like, people were doing drugs, and, like, there was all, you know, it was college stuff. And she was just, like, lost, like completely horrified by absolutely everything and completely overwhelmed and really, really struggled. And it's like, yeah, I didn't have like the smoothest life having seen some bad things, but at the same time, I wasn't as like floored by everything. I managed to get her through the shock. And so there's that in between goal of being prepared but not being traumatized.
Right. And the scary thing there too is that there's two ways to respond to it, you know, and it's to be horrified and a bit judgmental. You know, like, why are all these people doing these bad things? You know, which is usually the response you get from the child. You know, oh, that's wrong. You know, and then you have to be like, well, it doesn't make them a horrible person. You know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
That's one reaction. Overwhelmed, freaking out, you know, feel like they've been dropped in hell, surrounded by temptations for no reason. Or you get the opposite of, well, my parents are liars, and I was sheltered, so now I'm going to go, like, do everything. And that's equally not good. You know? You need to have some exposure before you reach that age. So.
True.
Those are the two ways that I've seen that go.
I have seen it go that way as well. it's the extremes. It's true. I went to a very strict Catholic school, and some of my friends had a bit of a culture shock when they moved away.
Option one and option two. That's what I've seen. Anyway.
So my favorite quote,
oh,
I'm going to do mine, which is a brevity. The prompt I chose was, there's no dearth in kindness in the world of ours, only in our blindness we gather thorns for flowers, which was the Gerald Massey quote. So I wrote, gathering thorns. In a field of young mullein, I am drawn to the bramble, insisting on planting fire thorn, exhilarated by the gamble. Plentiful possibilities of pleasant posies, but I will pluck the thorn-wielding beauties and conclude that charm correlates with harm. End poem.
I like this piece. It's a brevity, but it's rather verbose. There's quite a few, like, complex words in here that especially use alliteration to play off each other, like with plentiful possibilities, pleasant posies, and conclude that charm correlates with harm. You know, that both rhymes and has alliteration in it. So it's pretty complex for five little lines there. But I also like what it says, drawn to harsh things, you know, but finding them beautiful. And while there's lots of pleasant posies around, because you're attracted to harmful things, you're associating things that are attractive with harm, you know, and that's kind of like why can't I think, once bitten, twice shy kind of a thing. You know, you're drawn to the things that hurt you, which is, you know, kind of like, I love that as an interesting take on this concept. You know, when you don't see that it's harmful, or you even that you do see, but that's still the things that you're attracted to. You know, I love roses. I'm fully aware of the fact that they have thorns. I am fully aware that every time I go to trim back my roses, I'm going to scratch the mother loving crap out of my hands. Like, I know these things. I still choose to grow them. So I found that kind of interesting in here, because it's like with that saying that charm correlates with harm. You know, like, I love the things that hurt me. I'm attracted to the things that hurt me, and not to find the pleasant posy is really that luring. It's fascinating. I liked it in context with the quote, you know, where the quote is that in our blindness we gather thorns for flowers. Because we cannot see that they are thorns. But this, it almost says, hey, I'm aware that they're thorns, but it's still what I like.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking about my previous penchant for Bad Boys.
There's two ways you can take it. Like, I'm aware of the fact that I'm attracted to things that harm me, you know, and I know that. Or the second is, like, I like a challenge is another way you can take it. You know, like, why bother with posies when it doesn't have thorns? A little bit, I guess, masochistic. But I really enjoyed the piece. Like, I thought it was well done. And I just, some of the words you put in here, I really just enjoyed the words themselves. Like, I've always really liked the word brambles. I don't know why. I've always just been kind of attracted to that word. I like the way it sounds. I like what it makes me picture. I for some reason, I don't know. Sometimes when I hear certain words, I can almost taste things. That sounds really strange. But, like, when I read the word bramble, I almost taste, like, really, really ripe blackberries, like midsummer blackberries when I read the word bramble.
Yeah.
And it's, like, when I hear the word smoke, I can almost taste the smoke, too. So those tend to be my favorite kind of words, are words where I have almost a sensory experience tied with them. I don't think it's like synesthesia or anything like that. I think it's just really close associations from like experiences with the words, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I love that.
Flavor. So there's some words that I really like, and you use some of those in here that, I don't know, almost give this poem a sensory experience for me. So I enjoyed it.
That makes me so happy. I had to look up plants, I'm not going to lie. So the bramble came naturally to me, but then I looked up what is the softest plant because I wanted to be like the opposite of that. And several websites said the mullein because it's like this really like furry kind of leaf. So I looked that up. I actually didn't know what that was. And then I looked up like what is an extremely spiky thing that's horrible to have in your garden, and firethorn was there. So I was like, okay, I insist on planting that. So I cheated a little bit. I looked things up, but
I'm a bit of a plant nerd. I grew up out in the middle of the woods, so I know a lot of plants. And so it's funny when you say these things that you're looking for, like certain plants immediately pop into my head. You're like, I'm looking for a really soft plant, and my mind instantly goes lamb's ear. This is this plant that feels fuzzy and soft. It feels like a lamb's ear. It is the softest, most interesting texture of a plant. I love lamb's ear. And then when you say, like, a spiky, horrible plant, I think of Devil's Club, which looks violent and is violent, and it's just covered with huge barbs, and it's like this red and black, really violent-looking plant called a Devil's Club. Anyway, I'm a plant nerd, so... that's
I like that.
For me.
I should have consulted you. I would like to welcome Laurent to the show. Welcome.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Welcome, Laurent.
Okay, I didn't hear the mute go off. That's great. Yeah, you guys are having too much fun not to be joined.
It's good to hear from you.
Yes, indeed. I'm glad that some health concerns are behind me and I feel whole again.
Oh, that's really
good
to hear. You know, it's good to hear from you, too, because I was actually thinking about you literally yesterday. I was wondering how you were doing. I'm like, hey, I haven't heard from Laurent in a while. I was looking back at some old pieces.
Yeah, I kind of went into a cave for about 3 or 4 weeks and then came out feeling better.
Hi.
I'm glad you're feeling better.
Sometimes the cave is where you need to go.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry I missed your poem, Fasiana. I got it up on the screen in front of me. Now I'll read it and leave you a comment if you don't mind.
Oh, yes, that's fine. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I've put yours up if you're ready to share with us.
Wow. Quick treatment. By all means. You had a lot. I probably shouldn't have put one up.
No, it's good. This was the main contest, and we actually only had 4 entries, so I added other contests that were meant for next week just in case.
Yeah. I'm not sure this fits in with exactly with the topic, but it's called Blind
That's
I
all
See.
Good.
Braille sings to my blind eyes, a galvanic reaction to touch, soft skin of perfumed seduction, bathed in ardor, speaks loudly to the silent perception of inner sight. Clasp me, wrap me in willingness, tell our story anew in the hurried gasps of your growing urgency, falling like thunder, demanding lightning to strike twice the same spot. Oh, that Poseidon dove with such fury, or Mercury sped as quickly in the winged pursuit of divination. My hands, like eyes, plumb your core, tracing your trembling nakedness, flowing like a river across the curve and sweep of mythical landscape. Outer sight denied, inner visions frame of Venus, the voice of angels, and the appetite of Eros undiminished. Paired, we ride in spiritual union, joined by the duality of mind and body, locked in pleasure. And I have never seen it more clearly. End poem.
Lovely, right, Laurent? I really like this piece. It's sensual and passionate, and I love the way that it talks about, like, seeing perception not through the eyes, like perception through physical touch, but more than physical touch, it's almost like through emotional connection that's just, like, aided by physical touch, you know, and this intimacy. You know, this seems, you know, sexually intimate, but there's more to it than that, you know. There's the emotionality of the moment. It's almost like having the lights off. You know, whether or not someone is actually physically blind or not doesn't really matter too much, I think, for this poem because, you know, you can have a blindfold, you can just have your eyes closed, you can have the lights off, or you could just not be paying attention to what you see and be more engrossed by the experience and the emotionality and the feeling and the physical touch of the situation. So I really loved it. Because it's really more about that connection than the physical appearance of a person. So I thought this was a beautiful write. Thank you.
Thank you.
Feziana, what did you think?
I really liked Bathed in Ardor speaks loudly to the silent perception of inner sight. And then Wrap Me in Willingness. Again, like Babbler was saying, it shows that the emotional connection is so important because you're not just talking about, like, wrap me in your physical being, but it's the willingness that is an important aspect of it. I also really liked the demanding lightning strike twice in the same spot. Like, I took that as going for multiple orgasms. I thought that was really well done in the way that you expressed that. The Poseidon and Mercury references are great. I love mythology being put in there to get your point across. This is really classy and sensual and just wonderful word choices all throughout.
Thank you. I had intended the character to be blind. It's the only reason I use the word Braille, then it made sense in both directions.
Yeah, I really liked it. It did seem to me like the main character or the, you know, the narrator of the piece here was supposed to be blind, but I love that it was relatable even if you aren't, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Just that
thing. Oh, and I left it just vague enough so it could easily be interpreted both ways.
Agreed. I really liked it. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you for allowing me to.
Anytime.
Of course. You're always welcome.
Okay. Where to next?
Babbler, will you please read the poem by Weaver of Dreams?
Yeah. Of course. This is The Fear by Weaver of Dreams. I entered the blackness that was my daily life once more, met by the demanding, shrill sound of the alarm clock. I had to accept that it was morning, with no proof other than the strident noise that had awakened me. I stumbled around, showered, dressed, knowing there was no longer any elegance to my movements. I became aware that I was crouching again, not standing up straight. I realized that the hardest aspect of being blind was not the darkness. What I feared most were the traps waiting for me each day as I walked an impromptu obstacle course. I constantly felt the need to duck to avoid the huge black masses that were hurtling through the air straight toward me or put my arm over my head for protection. End poem. I really enjoyed this write. You know, like, it's an interesting take on it. Like, you know, it is, I think, more about, like, literal blindness. And there's some things here about just coping with the physical nature of that, you know, waking up to an alarm clock and not really being able to sense in the morning. You know, I have an alarm clock, but to be honest, I really just set it as, like, a paranoia thing more than an actual, like, to wake me up. Because the first thing that'll tell me whether or not I'm late in the morning is how dark it is outside. You know, and to not have that, I imagine, would be very strange for me, especially since I grew up, like, without power and really just used that as a clock for many years. You know, and then just the physical struggles of this, you know, realizing that you're crouching, you know, dealing with things that you can't see that are just acting as, like, blockages. But that not really being the problem. The big problem is the fear, the constant fear that you're going to be hit by something or hurt by something. And then, this, you know, more directly addressed in the last stanza, you know, like the need to duck to avoid the huge black masses that were hurtling through the air straight towards me. It's almost like an incomplete blindness or like a sensing of an object that you can't see, so you don't really know how big it is or how fast it's coming, you know, only having a vague idea that it's really even there. You know, I imagine like constantly ducking or avoiding things and not knowing whether or not you even needed to avoid them, and how strange that would be as a phenomenon. You know, it just really kind of puts it into a different light on, like, what really is the struggle of blindness. So, anyway, interesting, right? I enjoyed it. Laval, what was your take?
I realized that the hardest aspect of being blind was not the darkness. What I feared most were the traps waiting for me each day as I walked an impromptu obstacle course. The language in this is, it really conveys the sense of blindness in almost an intimate and disturbing way. Those black masses, for instance, the idea that you could be struck or trip and fall are viscerally outlined in this piece. It kind of gave me pause. Excellent piece.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, just that perspective on it. I agree. Just constantly not knowing if something's going to come out of nowhere or knock you on your ass. Great point. Athesiana, what did you think?
I really like this. It's a much more literal blindness than the other entries in the contest. But I think there's still, like, other aspects to it than the physical. I liked knowing there was no longer any elegance to my movements. Even without being able to see herself, like, in the mirror, feeling that there is that kind of jerkiness to the movement that is uncontrolled because of just the not being able to see really changes the way that you move, anticipating things that you might trip on and stuff like that, and just having that different sense of self in that awareness of how you must appear as you're trying to do things. I relate to that because I am certainly not very smooth moving with all my brain injury stuff. I have lost all elegance. But I think that this is something that when you can't even see yourself and know that there's something different, that would be such a challenge. I could feel that fear of needing to duck. Like, I get, like, this tingle at the back of my neck when I think about that feeling of, like, that you have to avoid something and you're not quite sure if it's there. Like, she really put us in that moment. I put my arms over my head for protection. Like, I felt the fear reading this, so I think she did a wonderful job.
Yeah, agreed. I think she does a great job of conveying that fear feeling, you know, and the doing what you can to protect yourself, and also being aware of the fact that there's no dignity in the appearance of that. Excellent comment, and a great write. Thank you, Weaver of Dreams. So what are we up to now?
Now we have one from Pam Ray. It's called The Gun and the Crow. The Gun and the Crow. A man stumbles, glary-eyed, into his garage, crowned with self-importance, pistol cocked, ready to aim and shoot. But the only intruder is an old crow who won't sit still, muttering and fluttering, hopping to and fro. Amongst the rafters, I ike a wind-up toy with a message or two to spare. The man mocks what he does not understand. With the coiled clutter of his thick tongue, he says, hold still, crow. And the crow says, I can't. I was born to move. I was born to fly. Then fly away from what is mine, says the man. But the crow just keeps on hopping around and around, like a merry-go-round of black feathers. Crow snaps the man. Don't you recognize who I am? No, says the old bird. I don't recognize you, because I'm blind. The barn cat scratched out my eyes. I barely escaped with my life. Then the man pulled the trigger and shot the bird in the heart. It fell to the cold cement floor. The man picked up the crow by its broken wing and tossed it outside. Damn bird, grumbled the man. You should have recognized my voice. After all, don't I yell at you every day to stay away from my grain? Don't I sing gospel songs every morning as I work in my field beneath the omnipresent scarecrow? And while the crow bled into the ground, the scavenger said a prayer of thanksgiving to the man and his gun. End poem.
Great read, please, Donna. And I really like this poem from Pam. It feels like a parable. You know, and it, part of it almost feels like a Western, you know. There's this, you know, crotchety old man all bleary-eyed that's going with, clearly with violence in his mind, pistol cocked, ready to shoot at what, you know, some kind of intruder in the garage, and it's a crow. And rather than just being like, oh, it's a dang crow and letting it out, there's instead like this conversation, which in my mind here, I picture is happening on some level, but is also not happening. Like, I still picture in my head, like, this crotchety old man waving this gun around at this bird in a garage, and the bird just squawking, and the old man grumbling, you know, but they're not actually being, like, there's this conversation happening, but it's all in subtext, you know? So to any onlooker, it would just look like an old man being like, get the heck out of my garage, and the crow being like, rah, you know. Anyway, that's what I'm seeing in my head is the scenario as I read this. You know, and the crow wants out of the garage, and the man wants the crow out of the garage, and, you know, the bird isn't recognizing that it's this crotchety old farmer, and he just, like, shoots him dead and blames him. Which, you know, is like a lack of kindness, a lack of empathy, a lack of understanding, and it really paints like this old man is just like this real a-hole, heartless person, you know, and it's a farmer. And then at the end, he's like, don't I sing gospel songs every morning? Like, that's supposed to be, you know, some kind of saving grace, you know, or I work in my field with a scarecrow. Like, shouldn't that, you know, like, because what? Because you have warning signs? That means it's okay to shoot someone? You know, and then the public is praising him as being, like, this wonderful provider. Because there's, like, I don't know, it feels like, you know, there's two sides to every story, but I feel like sometimes there's even more sides than that. And that's kind of what this piece gets at to me. It's like a multifaceted parable, because depending on your perspective, you see a different story. You know, if you're a crow, you see one story. If you're the farmer, you see another story. And if you're the people in the town, you see a completely different story. So I think this is a wonderful usage of the word blindness. And I love the way that it's done with so many different perspectives. And again, the additional perspective of, like, a completely separate onlooker just watching this guy yelling at a crow like a crazy person in his garage. So, excellent write, Pam. I really enjoyed it. Aphasiana, what'd you think?
I really liked it. Pam's great at doing conversations and stories in her poetry. And it feels like a poem, but it also feels like a script, because you can really imagine it. And like you said, you can imagine it in more than one way, because you can picture it where it's the conversation happening, but you can also picture it where it's just the man talking and the crows jumping around and the man seeing it as more than it is. I kind of wonder if in this she has kind of a subtext where even though the crow's physically blind, in a way it's the man who is blind in the sense that he's not understanding the crow's side of things and the maybe the place of the crow in the environment, but also the fact that he's feeding the scavengers. He's blind to even his own role within this circle of life. I don't know. I feel like there's even more to it that I'm not quite getting yet. But I think Pam does a wonderful job of giving us something to think about, but also making it a funny read. So she's really good at that balance.
Yeah, agreed. I do think there are so many different ways to come at this. It's really fascinating. And yeah, I've seen quite a few wonderful narratives from Pam. Excellent comment. Laurent, what did you think?
That was like Babs writing. Damn bird, grumbled the man. You should have recognized my voice. After all, didn't I yell at you every day to stay away from my grain? Didn't I sing gospel songs every morning as I work in my field beneath the omnipresent scarecrow? Well, the barn cat scratched out my eyes. I barely escaped with my life. You know, the crow establishes his reasons for being there. Blaming the farmer for his cat, blaming the whole farm, if you will. It's something of a moralistic piece. It's almost an apology to killing the crow, because the farmer's resentful at his unwillingness to leave after being given the chance. He recites his trials and tribulations over the years as if in a further excuse. I found the dialogue very realistic and the storytelling superior.
Yeah, I really liked the flavor of the dialogue, too. I thought it had a lot of great texture to it and felt real. You know, like I could hear this crotchety old guy just cussing up a storm without cussing in his barn. So, excellent comment. And wonderful writing, Pam. Thank you. What do we got going on now?
So that was the last one of that particular contest, the last of the blindness. But we do have another contest we're going to dig into, which is Gray Area. And that one has a few different prompts that all have the word gray in it. And the first prompt is, the color of truth is gray. So I'm just going to say one prompt at a time, and we'll read through the poems that are of that prompt. So the color of truth is gray, and we're going to read one by Daniel Vecino. We did see him earlier tonight in Babbler's contest, but now he's also in mine. So here we go. Sorry, I minimized by mistake. Here it is. Oh, while I do that, I want to say that Mamiel pointed out that she thought Pam's poem was a commentary on the abuse of minorities, which I think is a really interesting perspective on that.
I like that.
Laurent, would you please read? Yeah, it is. Thank you, Mamiel. Laurent, would you read the one by Daniel, please?
Certainly.
Thank you.
This is called The Gray Mystic. Of the creatures yet discovered who hide in the unwanted places of man, of the unexplained terror that suddenly bathes travelers and explorers to choose the path most comforting, of the strange shapes that ride deep ocean waves and question the sanity of late night sailors, of these worlds beyond human senses, I am the Alpha. A shadow reflected from shadows, yellowish blue beyond nature's green, the breath between inhale and exhale, the unseen hemisphere after rainbow's end. Of human interaction, I am an open book, binding broken like the spine of an antelope skeleton trampled from a migrating herd. Pages aged of 1,000 decades of sunlight and rain, translated 100 generations over till the Rosetta Stone crumbles and cover faded beyond even what I can see. And so I continue to search with outstretched invisible hands for the one with a vision beyond focus, hearing beyond the audio realm and touch with quantum mechanics beyond distance, and hope be my eternal loving companion, as I've seen glimpses throughout the eons of those who perceive me, even if just for a moment, between memories, I am a gray mystic. End poem.
Wonderful read. I really enjoyed this write. Just, I don't know, for me it was almost like an unraveling of Tunes with a capital T kind of a thing. You know, like things that are, but are forgotten just due to time. You know, like how things came to be or how things started or creatures that were and aren't anymore. Or, you know, there's so many different iterations of this as a concept, but things that are just like barely outside the realm of human perception or understanding, but sometimes just kind of brush against it. And I love that just as a concept. And I love the way that he approaches it. You know, the different takes on what that can mean. I really liked yellowish blue beyond nature's green. And I guess what I really liked about this, and this is going to be a weird experience when I'm relating, that I don't think I've ever talked about it before, but when I close my eyes and I look at, like, right where, sometimes I try and intentionally focus on right where my eyelids meet when I have my eyes closed. I love doing that because it's a really interesting color, and I've always kind of thought of it as like a yellowish blue, but it's not really a green. And it's not really an aqua. It's this really weird color. And I've always kind of liked looking at that band of color when I have my eyes closed. I don't know, it made me think of that, especially thinking about things that people don't really understand or just barely touch perception. So I thought that was fascinating because I had an interesting, like, weird experience that I related to it with. You know, or the things we don't see after the end of a rainbow, you know. I really like, too, finding broken, like the spine of an antelope skeleton trampled from a migrating herd, just busted open and, like, run to a pulp. You can't even really tell what it was, you know, and for it to be, like, a book related to that, and then even more than that, it's a metaphorical book on top of that. So it's like a human interaction that, like, nobody really remembers and is completely unrecognizable at some point. I love the words and scenarios that are kind of used to describe those kind of tickling sensations of perception. I thought this was beautifully done. And like I said, to me, it kind of tickles on, like, truth with a capital T, but never uses that word, and just kind of lets me introduce it as the reader. So I love this piece. I thought it was very well done. Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah, I found this poem to be of profoundly metaphysical nature. It really refers to ideas, you know, a reality that exists outside of human sense perception, don't you think? I mean, maybe metaphysical is the wrong word. I don't know. I remember that Aristotle talked about the need to understand all reality through reasoning, which is kind of a metaphysical characteristic. And certainly there have been a lot of metaphysical poets, but when he speaks of human interaction, I am an open book, as if humanity's story, day by day, is contained within him. And to me, that's a being that's far superior. Now, the great mystic could be considered a god, for instance. I don't know. But, you know, he's looking for the one with a vision beyond focus. Hearing down the audio realm is all very metaphysical characteristics. It's gorgeously written, absolutely beautiful piece.
I love that take on it. I had also kind of thought it played with the idea of God or, you know, religion, but in like an abstract and very open way. Wonderful comment. Thank you, Laurent. Faziana, what are your thoughts?
I really liked the line, translated 100 generations over till the Rosetta Stone crumbles. Each time you translate something, a little bit is lost. So for it to be translated over and over and over again, it's like a really extreme version of that telephone game you play as kids where you all say the thing that you hear, and then it comes back to the original person, and it's not at all what it was in the beginning. So that idea of it being translated over 100 generations, that things are going to change, and that maybe that's talking about how we may misinterpret things from religion. Like, you know, if the Bible, for example, had gone through so many different versions and passed down from different people and changed, then do we know exactly what it was intended to be? And I don't know if it's talking like specifically about a particular book, because I think the book is supposed to be metaphorical of like we are the open book, either the spiritual being that it's talking about or humanity. But I love the way that it's written. Babbler already pointed out, binding broken like the spine of an antelope, skeleton trampled from a migrating herd. Like, that is a very striking image that you can't help but picture. And I've dealt with a lot of broken books, and I can imagine kind of what he's trying to get at there. But even that part is a metaphor, so it's like a metaphor within a metaphor, and just brilliant. I like at the end, those who perceive me, even if just for a moment, between memories, that like just a little glimpse between memories, such a small, tiny moment of seeing the truth. This is wonderful. It took me by surprise. It's not what I expected from that prompt, but I love that.
Daniel has depth.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Love his poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Mamia says, Gandalf the Grey. Yes. But now, Gandalf the White.
Yes. The great mystic, that's like right where my mind went to, but I'm like, this has nothing to do with that. Like, you're a weird Lord of the Rings talk to yourself. Not to Mamia, to me. To myself. I'm like, not what this is about.
But, you know, Gandalf, how do you not connect him to everything?
No.
Speaking of Mamya, though, we have one by her. Babbler, would you read that one?
Oh, absolutely. This is Monochromacy by Mamya. Light crawled out from the womb of the night. Shadows danced in hidden crevices, enticing me. Muted sounds play a symphony in E minor. Overcast skies hid a contemptuous ball of resentment, while creeping fog encompassed all in a gray embrace. I walked, contemplating this monochrome world, leaving dark footsteps behind as I traversed the gloom. Ravens overheard form a parliament, debating over carrion. On I went until I met a flower, devoid of color, but full of glowing aura. Hope swelled inside my chest, fit to bursting. While there are no colors here, there is light. End poem. Ah, I thought this was really beautiful. It paints so many different elements that works so well with the title, you know, as setting the scene, the monochromacy, you know, everything being of the same color. But it even starts with light crawled out from the womb of the night, which is such a, it's a gorgeous image, the womb of the night. Picture, I almost picture like a moon being born, you know, just the birth of day, you know, the birth of light. I think such a great concept. You know, and with the introduction of light, you see all of these things that you didn't see before. You know, shadows dancing. There wouldn't be shadows without light. You know, there'd be no overcast skies. There'd be no fog to witness. You know, all of these things that can be seen now. And yet there's still kind of a dark tone. You know, it's E minor, the symphony is in. You know, it's not... That's not a happy tune, kind of downcast and a bit frightening. Overcast skies hit a contemptuous ball of resentment. You know, that's quite a few bits of negativity kind of wound up in there, you know, leaving dark footsteps behind as I traverse the gloom. So I just, was really... interested in like the darkness of it, despite it starting with the birth of light, you know, but it kind of makes sense to me, you know, that, you know, just because light is born doesn't mean suddenly everything is bright. I almost think too of like when you've been indoors all day in kind of a dark environment and then you go outside and it's bright daylight, like that blindness that's a bit uncomfortable, you know, and kind of makes everything look garish for a while. It kind of piques my mind in that direction as well. But then to see, you know, hope swelling, you know, a glowing aura, like there being this optimism at the end, you know, that despite lack of color, now there is light. So I really enjoyed this. And to me, it almost felt like there was a spin on it, too, that's a bit like fighting depression. You know, and how, like, everything can seem bleak, and that even if your world seems kind of gray, you know, at least there's light in gray. So, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a great piece. What did you think, Fabiana?
I think that you're right about it being connected to depression, that it works really well as a metaphor in that way. The first stanza just floored me. I love it so much. Light crawled out from the womb of the night. The womb of the night. I just love that. And then leaving dark footsteps behind as I traverse the gloom. I mean, I've never thought of footsteps being something that could be dark. Like footprints, not are not necessarily dark, and the footsteps, I think of the sound, but it kind of makes me think that she's leaving that darkness behind. So if we're walking away from depression, then bits of her own darkness are being left imprinted as she walks towards the light. And while there are no colors here, there is light. I can just picture this kind of black and white scene where everything is grayscale, but it's starting to get a little bit brighter around the things that make her happy. And Babbler, you were talking before about how when you're upset and you saw this one little flower in a ditch, it kind of changed your mood. And she talks about, where is it now? There's a place with a flower, I think. I've lost it. There's something about, oh, here. On I went until I met a flower, devoid of color, but full of a glowing aura. So I was kind of picturing she discovers this flower, just like you did, and everything becomes like just a little bit brighter. And she still might be in that depression, but there's hope of some things are making it brighter. I thought that was beautiful.
Yeah, I thought of that as well, you know, the little flower comment. You know, and that's exactly how I used that, too. So great comment, and I agreed with that hope. Laurent, what did you think?
Yeah, when I saw the title, I thought we were going to get a work on the deficiency, the disease of monochromacy, which is the inability to see things in color. And it could very well be that all the way through, someone giving a very eloquent write on exactly that subject and how it affects their lives. But, you know, you guys are probably right. It could also be the monochromacy of the soul, the darkness of a depression, because the two are really pretty equivalent. So I think you could read it both ways. Because she called it monochromacy, I was almost tempted to say, well, that's what this is about, but there's so many other things in there that suggest otherwise.
Looking at it, too, from the perspective of monochromacy, you know, the condition, you know, it's interesting because it almost gives it a bit of an optimistic swirl as well. Is like, well, you can't see the color, but at least you can see light. You know, there's still all these things I can see. Yeah, the aura, you know, to see things. I bet you would see, and this obviously is speculation, but, you know, much like people who are missing senses, it kind of heightens your other senses. I wonder if you'd be even more in tune and sensitive to the effects of light in the environment.
Don't insects respond to the intensity of a flower's color as opposed to the color?
I'm not sure about the intensity of the color, but I know a lot of flowers have UV signatures that we can't see that do a lot more to attract the insects.
That could very well
the color
be
that,
like an aura.
Yeah, there's a UV light that the bees and other insects and pollinators can see that's like a really interesting signature. I actually did a little bit of work on that in college, but anyway. A different story. Yeah, no, but I like that as a concept, especially since it's a flower. Great comment. What are we up to now?
So prompt two was the gray area, the place between black and white, that's the place where life happens, which is a Justin Timberlake quote. And Doc Frank chose that quote and wrote Solving Life's Mysteries. Few things in life are clearly black or white. Those successful can differentiate the meaning of the gray areas where we live. This problem-solving competency essential for success. End quote.
Great read. And a nice brevity, you know, and a nice direct message that I really enjoyed. You know, because few things in life are clearly black or white. You know, everything typically, from most things, unless you're getting, like, really out into the fringe, there's a balance of goodness or badness to things, or, like, upsides and downsides, or, you know, differences in perspective. And so we do really kind of live in the gray area in that concept, you know, and our ability to differentiate how we feel about those differences, I think, is major. You know, problem-solving competency, yes, but I think morality and emotional intelligence as well. So, great poem from Frank. Ephesiana, your thoughts?
That last line, I think, was my favorite. Problem-solving competency essential for success. You know, being able to see both sides and decide where in the gray things may lie is definitely key to navigating life. So I think that there's wisdom in that.
Agreed. There's wisdom to be had in this piece. I agree with you. And I do think it hinges on that last line. Laurent, what did you think?
I thought you guys covered that brevity perfectly. When you read something like, few things in life are clearly black or white, you go, well, of course they're not clearly black or white. Everything is almost a gray area. But when it's stated sometimes like this, so plainly and cleanly, and accompanied with wisdom, it really stands out. I like it a lot.
Yeah, there's something nice occasionally about a clearly stated poem. You know, it feels
Absolutely true.
It feels true because it's so direct.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Then you don't have to suss out the meaning. You know what I mean? Like, it's right there for you to think about and kind of chew on. It's a great comment. What are we doing now?
So prompt three was, I like the muted sound, the shroud of gray, and the silence that comes with fog. So there's one by Sydney Pierce. Babbler, would you read that one, please?
Absolutely. This is In the Gray by Sydney Pierce. I think a thick blanket covers the hills, and muted footsteps go unheard. The man walked with purpose and carried a blade in his pocket. He thumbed it carefully with each step. He would be unseen on this night. His taste for violence was only allowed after seeing so many horrors. The badge on his chest screamed fairness for any who would listen. By night, he made himself unknowable with a grin and two bloody hands. He pried them into unsuspecting locks and broke bones like glass. He remained untouched in the gray. Never again would a warm body leave him in the night. End poem. This is a really interesting piece. It's kind of sinister. Not kind of. It is sinister. you know, and just the way that it starts, you know, like there's a thick blanket that's kind of making everything quiet. And this man who has a knife that he's thumbing while sneaking around unseen, enacting, you know, violence and horror really sets a weird scene. And then when you get to the middle stanza there, it flips it. You know, the badge on his chest screamed fairness for any who would listen, which makes me think that, you know, maybe some kind of police or law man of some kind or, you know, some kind of doler of justice. In a way, you know, whether literally or figuratively, you know, that goes around in the night, kind of attacking the attackers, you know. You know, because it just seems, even in the context of police, et cetera, to go on to, making himself unknowable in the night with a grin and two bloody hands, prying them into unsuspecting locks and breaking bones like glass. You know, there's almost, like, the word choice there really gives it, like, a taste of enjoying the violence. You know, a grin and two bloody hands. You know, just, you know, not grimly carrying out this justice with, like, some kind of heartbreak or internal battle. It's more like reveling in it, which I found really interesting. You know, it feels very vigilante, except there's a mention of this badge. And then those last two lines, he remained untouched in the gray. Never again would a warm body leave him in the night, like somebody had left him. And now there's, like, this revenge that needs carried out. It's very creepy. but I enjoy it. It's mysterious and violent and dark and interesting. So, wonderful write from Sydney Pierce. Laurent, your thoughts?
It's an intriguing write, isn't it? When I read
Definitely.
His taste for violence was only allowed after seeing so many horrors, followed by the badge on his chest screamed fairness for any who would listen. I do believe this is a cop, and he's seen so
mm-hmm.
many horrible things that he's developed a taste for violence, but somehow it's channeled through maybe taking revenge on people who, quote-unquote, deserve it, as a way to somehow touch that spot in him that needs that violence, that maybe sees situations where he would love to use violence and can't. It's a very psychological poem. It really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. That twistedness, yeah, makes you think you're doling out justice when really you've become the horror. Excellent comment, Laurent. I love it. Afasiana, your take.
I thought it was fascinating and a little bit scary. It reminded me a lot of shows like Dexter, where I don't actually watch it myself, but I know my husband does, where it's like he only kills the bad guys because he sees them through his work as people who are like slipping through the cracks. They'll get away because there wasn't enough evidence or something like that, but he knows they're guilty. So it's kind of like Ron said. I'm thinking of, like, in the movie Venom when he's saying, we can only eat the really bad guys. And he's like, bad guy? When he sees them. And he's like, yeah, you can get him. But it's like the giving in to that darker side of yourself because you know that you because you've seen such things. It's terrifying. It's really well done. I like that he remained untouched in the gray, never again would a warm body leave him in the night. This is, you know, it's so intense. I mean, we can hope that maybe he's not actually killing. You know, maybe he's playing, like, a violent video game at the end of the night to get rid of those urges. That's what I do. I don't know. I you know, coping mechanism. I think this is really well done, and it has an eeriness to it. I'll have to read this one to my husband because he likes that darkness.
It is beautifully eerie. Great God. Great comment. I love the optimism of, like, maybe it's a video game. Love that. Where are we off to now?
Now we have one by Blue Harrison. Laurent, would you read that for us, please?
Yes, ma'am. Let me get there. This is called The Altar of Grays. Fall gentle within my spread. Spunlight spool to dark palms. and the spill of intent released from every corner. I'm going to start again, if you don't mind. Fall gentle within my spreads, spun lights fool the dark palms, and the split of intent released from every corner of my... I made the same mistake. Oh, God damn it. Okay. Third time's a charm. Fall gentle within my spread. Spun light spooled the dark palms, and the spill of intent released from every corner of my passion. Too long cocooned, a crow crowned as the last kernel is wept from fertile bosom of sprawled terra queen. So I sip insidious, ply embrace to ground zero, that place want wanders, intrigued by certain smile, only to feel pinned. Down we all float, whether larks or horned owl, a nest must be made, and you, my love, shall sacrifice your colors to the altar of grays, and lay here with me, fetal, in arms of obscurity. And Paul, I do apologize for those mistakes. The line endings grab me every time. What's it called when you move from one stanza to the next with a sentence? I forget. It's a thing.
I can't remember what it's called, but I trip over it as well, so I think you did a wonderful job.
I doubt it. All right, doubt I did. No, the way she put this together was, it brought me up short a little. I wasn't ready for the form. I would have liked to have read it first to myself.
Yeah, well, it's hard to go into a cold read sometimes. Sorry, Babbler, I talked over you.
Well, because
it's okay.
I wasn't sure
love to talk over
when you're reading it, whether, and the first stanza, released from every corner, and then ended there, because you can then legitimately say, of my passion, too long cocooned, a crow crowned. And you can do that all the way down, but I wasn't sure which way to do it. I'm sorry.
No, you're right. It works both ways because, like, even with intrigued by a certain smile only to feel pinned, but it could be only to feel pinned down. Like,
right.
I think every stanza here could go either way.
It flummoxed me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Blue doesn't often
do
that.
That down has a double meaning as well, you know, to feel pinned down. But then it goes to we all float, whether larks or horned owl. And the fact that we then go straight into birds makes me think feathers, you know, which is down, but in a different context. You know, I think there's some real intentionality to that. And I really enjoyed this piece. You know, to me, it's about death and dying and the way that contributes to life cycles, you know. Fall gentle within my friends, fun light fooled to dark palms, you know, just unwind, basically, like become undone, you know, and intent doesn't matter anymore when things are all said and done. You know, I it's funny for me to say that because I argue all the time that intent does matter because in most situations that I hear it applied to, it does. But once everything is all said and done and you're dead, you know, it doesn't really matter all the things that you wanted to do or the way that you intended things to happen because you kind of, you're omitted from the equation altogether. But, you know, to look at, like, something cocooned for too long or a crow that was crowned as the last kernel is left, you know, so like the endings of things. But then to kind of fall back into the earth, you know, to fall back down and to float down into the altar of grays, lay here with me, fetal, in arms of obscurity. You know, fetal talks about like rebirth, you know, in the way that everything dies, at least from a biological perspective, you know, gets kind of re-uptaken into the cycle of life in way, you know, through decomposition, et cetera. I think it's very beautifully done. There's this gentleness to it and almost like a comfort that doesn't really shy away from the darkness of it either. Like, it's not, it's barely softened the edges of talking about death. You know, it hasn't, like, painted it in, like, some wonderful light, but at the same time, it there's comfort to it as well. So I really enjoyed the piece. I thought it was wonderfully done, and I thought it was beautifully emotive. I don't know, it felt almost like a gray tulle, you know, like it felt smoky. Anyway, I really enjoyed the piece. Ephesiana, what did you think?
I think it's really interesting how it was written. Like, it's very tricky to know when to pause in my mind or saying it out loud, but I kind of like that. I'm curious about the want being capitalized. I really emphasize that word. This place wanders. And down is capitalized, but often the beginning of words, a beginning of phrases are not. It's a rare capitalization in this piece. So like you said, Babbler, it has multiple meanings, so maybe that's to make us think about that and take a good look at the word down. And I really liked the final sentence, fetal in arms of obscurity. I think that's a really great phrasing.
Yeah, agreed. I liked that end phrase, too. And I do think there's kind of a playing with meaning going on here. You know, maybe even a little more than I picked up on, that maybe some more readings would benefit. Laurent, what are your thoughts?
Well, in the first stanza, I do see the line, full gentle within my spread, just to suggest someone falling into her arms, because she speaks of spun light, spooled to dark palms, and the spill of intent. And then she speaks of my passion, and I think that is separate from the sentence above, of my passion, too long cocooned, a crow crowned. It's kind of abstract there, so I'm not sure what to make of that, although I see the words fertile bosom or sprawled terra queen, which I feel refers again back to the woman. So she seeps insidious. She becomes tricky, sly. She plies embrace to ground zero. Ground zero would be that place within her lover where want wanders and or exists. You know, she feels, perhaps, intrigued by a certain smile, one or the other. But we all float where the larks or horned owls, a nest must be made. If you're going to love me, we need to make our nest. And you are going to have to abandon your wild ways. And you, my love, shall sacrifice your colors to the altar of graves and lay here with me. I may be all wrong. That's just what crept into my head.
I really love your sensual take on it. It's not what I saw, but I do see what you saw now that you're talking about it. I kind of love that take, you know, the idea of sacrifice for partnership in order to kind of say I think that's on it. Thank you. Comment. What are we up to now, Ephesiana?
I'm going to read mine real quick, but we're not going to comment on me. We're going to go into the next one after. It's just I wrote to the third prompt, so I'm going to do it. Finding fog. While others crave the vibrancy of sun-soaked summer, I find peace in the mist mistaken as forlorn. Cacophony of the city fades into the fog. The world shrinks as visibility does. A private sanctuary within a cloud. My craniosacral rhythm finds Earth's beat. Sitting bound angel, feeling free. End poem.
Well done.
Thank you. And I only have five more minutes, so I want to jump to the one by Soul. And Babbler, I think it's your turn to read.
All right. This is Sour by Soul, and it goes like this. Tuna sandals, oh, the Ontario blues, gray matter, a careless whisper in secret winds. I find the basement is enclosed, but its salvation wraiths a poison apple, the one I would share with the fruitiest of gangsters, and I am addicted to its nocturnal seed, a little glow. And it's all better for the ghouls of Tokyo, could eat a complete meal in the most delicate of my wisdom, a delicacy. A hard drive into the rain, and there I disappear into the fog. Nobody cares. Just Santa and his satanic minions bat an eye to my most treasured of gunshot pillow thoughts delivered by a sour apple in the guise of a black rose. Oh, how I love the thorns. But I fucking hate the petals, for it is they who try to consume me, the bud of this fragile earth I call my body, to be used like an unidentified corpse, flying object, the sweet serenade of lies, however riveting, kills me every time. End poem. Ah, I love this. There's double meanings in here. There's midline rhymes in here. There's some really interesting word stresses. You know, like, I'm addicted to its nocturnal seed, a little glow, and it's all better the ghouls of Tokyo could eat a complete meal. The stressing and the rhythm of that, I think, is just wonderful because it rhymes glow with Tokyo, and you're midline there, but you can really still feel the rhythm and the story that it takes. You know, I'm like the soul-eating ghouls of Tokyo, and just, I don't know, I found this very fascinating. I don't have a lot of time, and I don't want to hog up all of it, but I do want to give it one some wonderful comments. Like a hard drive into the rain, when I first read hard drive, I think of electronics, and you don't want that to go in the rain because it'll destroy it, but it could also just mean like a drive, like a furious drive through the rain, a long drive, in a car, which is completely different. I feel like that's intentional, that mind twist. You know, and again, the play on words, like just Santa and his satanic minions, you know, very similar lettering and very different meanings, and to take Santa and kind of twist it into something evil rather than joyous. And just all these twistings back and forth to take things that are good and make them bad, and to take things that are bad and make them good, and play with the double meanings of things works so well as a concept of gray, you know, in the gray, you know, and just be killed by lies, like literally almost killed by kindness, kind of. I love it. I could read it a few more times. I could leave a lot more comments, but I want to give other people time to comment. Laurent, your thoughts?
Well, this is a toughie for me because I'm very literal-minded. And if I do not understand the metaphors and the references, I become lost, wandering in that gray fog we've been talking about. As I read this, I find the phrasing interesting, the imagery interesting, and it's very abstract to me. So rather than ruin the quality of this piece, I would much rather let two capable persons like yourself deliver their interpretations. I do like it.
I think your mind is quite capable. Thank you,
Robert. I've been sitting here, my dear, and about the only thing that makes any sense to me is, oh, how I love the thorns, but I fucking hate the petals, for it is they who try to consume me, the bud of this fragile earth I call my body. All right, I do understand that. The things that are beautiful are more of a danger to her than the things that potentially will hurt, because the buds are going to use her in a variety of ways, which she will not like, using lies, perhaps. I mean, that's about the best I can do. I'm sorry.
No,
Oh, no, don't apologize.
I don't need to apologize. Thanks, Laurent. I'll see you on
2:30 in the morning, and my head doesn't necessarily work that well this time of the morning.
I don't know if mine ever does. I love that line, actually. What you just pointed out was the my favorite part. Oh, how I love the thorns, but I fucking hate the petals, for it is they who try to consume me, the bud of this fragile earth I call my body. You weren't here yet earlier, Laurent, but this works really well with a prompt that that Babbler had in her previous contest, and actually I wrote about being most attracted to plants that hurt me, which really was about being more attracted to men who hurt me.
I caught a little bit.
There's this connection there. It was interesting that it works with both contests. Flying objects, the sweet serenade of lies, but unidentified flying objects, except it's an unidentified corpse flying object. So it works with the UFO thing, but it plays with it some more. And it does go back and forth with all of these images of things that are can be good or bad. The fruitiest of gangsters, something that's bad, kind of like made into a lighter thing, poison apples. But it makes me think about the gray of not fitting in being black or white, but it also, it says in the end, after all, this is part sinner, part saint. So it's like there is a good side and a bad things to all things, and they're making reference to the overall concept of the show in addition to the specific contest. So we are out of time. We're actually over time. We've been cut off. Thank you so much for calling in, Laurent. Thank you for being here, Babbler, and your inspiring contest. Thank you to Fill My Eyes for giving us this time on the air. And thank you to everyone who wrote and was willing to share your writing with us. Your poems are the soul of our show, and we are privileged to get to read them and comment on them. I hope that you'll all check out our contests. Babbler and I both always have some kind of contest going on. So check out Babbler or Aphasiana on allpoetry.com, and you could be on our next show. Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.